Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Rowell, and I'm a very excited alcoholic. I'm excited to be an alcoholic, and I'm excited to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm excited to be asked to participate in the 27th Annual Tri-State Roundup in Laughlin. And I want to thank Rob for inviting me, and I want to thank Joe for letting me stay after he found out who was talking. And I'm also excited to be on my honeymoon. I'm on my honeymoon. My wife, Carla Rowell, the former Carla Moore, sitting right down here. We were married on May 7th. Married on May 7th. Yeah, so we're still on our honeymoon. We left May 8th, we live in Tahunga, L.A., and we left May 8th after we went to our morning meeting, and we haven't been home yet. We went across the country, drove to Colorado, and then to Omaha, where my sponsor lives, and visited there, and Carla talked at their meeting, and then we went up to visit her sister in Wisconsin, and then we went to Akron and saw the Dr. Bob's house and the Mayflower Hotel and St. Thomas Hospital and the Gatehouse and all the AA archives around there. And then we went down and saw my sister in Wichita, then her sponsor in Austin, and we stopped in Dallas and had a meal with and stayed at with Beverly and George, some friends of ours there. We stayed with AA and friends and talked with AA friends and ate with AA friends across the country and family. And then we went to Scottsdale, Arizona. And now here's the deal. Almost 2 years ago, August 8th of 2009, Carla and I were invited. We've been friends for 13 years. We both live in, we went to a little meeting in North Hollywood, California. For years, we sat two seats away from each other at a Saturday morning book study or a step study. So we've been friends, and we were both speaking at this conference in Scottsdale almost 2 years ago. And we just started talking. We really hadn't sat down and talked. We had breakfast together, and that was good. We had lunch together, and we ended up sitting by the pool and going to some meetings together, and that was fun. So we, when it was time to go home, we asked Rusty, who was recording this. Rusty was recording this. Rusty and Carol, if we could use their printer to print out our boarding passes, and we ended up sitting together on the flight home, and I didn't want it to end, so I asked her if she wanted to go see a play. And she said, yeah. And so we've been playing ever since. And we have this beautiful AA relationship, which is now a beautiful AA marriage. And, you know, I'm almost in tears about it. And I'm sure that if you're new here, if you're in your first 90 days, you're probably thinking, isn't that just great? Isn't that just special that you could have your little AA honeymoon and your little AA relationship and live in your little AA LA home? And maybe when you get home to your little AA marriage home, you'll find it's on fire. Maybe you had an earthquake and it'll just fall in a big crack somewhere. Because that's the kind of things I thought when I was new, and people would talk about how wonderful their lives are since they got sober. And so if that's what you're thinking, I'm on your side. I dig it. I'm glad you're thinking that. I'm glad you're there. I'm excited about your thinking my house should burn down. Because you're here anyway, and I love that. When I went to my first AA meeting, I did not go to stay sober. I did not come into AA to find out what the secret to life is and how I can live happily and comfortably without drinking. No, I didn't. I had a couple of friends who had gotten sober in AA, and you know the thing is, if you see people in your life that you drank and used with, by the way, I used other things besides alcohol. You know, I mean, I grew up in the 60s. I'm not going to try to hide it or act cocked about, you know, outside issues. Who the hell? I always wonder, what outside issue did you use? because I only used, I mean, I used illegal drugs, but I only used everyone I ever heard of. And some of them, frankly, I didn't care about. I didn't care for them, so I only used them like 4 or 5 times. You know, I mean, if it irritates anybody that I mention illegal drugs in an AA meeting, I'm sorry. I mean, alcohol was an illegal drug when Bill and Bob were using it. But still, if I had known, if I had known, really, because you just don't know where your life's going when you're living your life. If I could have seen the future, you know, the first time somebody said, "Hey, man, try this," I would have said, "God, I'd love to, but I'm going to be speaking in an AA meeting in 30 years. Yeah, and I don't want to piss anybody off, okay? You know, we'll talk about our children and our driving and our work and everything that we did while we were drinking. But who don't you talk about drugs? And it's like part of my story. I can't help it. This woman I know in Canada said anybody who mentions illegal drugs from an AA podium is in violation of the fifth tradition. I don't know. The fifth tradition says we carry this message, our message, to the alcoholic who still suffers. Our message is not don't drink. That ain't it. Our message is to take these 12 steps and try to move from a self-center to a God center, where you can live happily and comfortably without drinking. And whatever is part of your story, I think we're obligated to tell that. Anyway, I don't want to get into a big long thing, but but I was hoping to get a cheer out of it anyway. So people that you drink and use with, and they get sober in AA, you can't not notice it. You know, you can't not notice that they are where they say they're going to be when they say they're going to be there, appropriately dressed and speaking in whole sentences. You know? So this friend of mine, Teddy, it seemed like every time we would get together, she would always say something about AA. Not exactly, not like try to jug. Doug, why don't you come to a meeting with me? And she's just like, you know, we'd be talking. I'd say, I got to go to the cleaners before they close. Oh, the one on Foothill? I go to a meeting right across the street from there. It's great. Isn't that nice for you? And I told her, you know, I'm thinking about getting one of those. You seen those Toyota pickups, the Tundra? They're pretty cool. Yeah, she said, my sponsor has one. Oh, shut up with the sponsor and the meeting and the big book. And but she was pretty cool until one time I finally got tired of her hints. And I said, Teddy, let me tell you something. If I see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA. And she visibly bit her lip. Really. Really, she said, if you see alcohol interfering with your life. I mean, I was working as a freelance stagehand at the time. I worked in TV, on TV shows. And I had a pretty good reputation, and I was getting some pretty good jobs. She mentioned that I had lost 2 jobs in the last year. Because of my drinking, and it was true. I had a good job at CBS that I'm working on this show, and I got, before I went to work, I got too drunk to work, so I didn't go. You know? I wasn't going to go make a fool of myself, so they fired me. And so the next time I had this great job on the show at NBC, and I got too drunk, but I went to work anyway. And they still fired me. And it seemed like you can't win. But she mentioned that I had lost these 2 great jobs in the last year. And I said, yeah. And she said, you know, you've been asked not to come to your daughter's house anymore. Well, that was basically true. My daughter at the time was about 12 years old. And her mother and I had split up when she was about 2 years old. And her mother remarried. She married this great guy named Stu. And I like him. We would have been friends whether there was any family connection or not. But I was still part of my daughter's life. And one day I was supposed to go over on a Saturday afternoon, pick her up. We were going to go to a movie. And I got up in the morning, and I'm knocking around the house, and I had, you know, had a beer for breakfast, a couple of beers, you know, like people do. And so then, you know, I had stuff to do in the afternoon, so I didn't have time to just sit around and drink beer, so I switched to whiskey. And so by the time I got over to Star's house, I'm a sort of a compulsive overdrinker, you know. I had overdrank that day, but I thought, well, geez, and I knew I was too drunk, but I tried to act like I was just in a good mood and goofy, you know, so, and maybe they wouldn't notice. They noticed, so I was only there for about 5 minutes, and my daughter kind of went in her room, and her stepfather took me out on the front porch, and he said, Doug, I want to make this real clear. He said, you are welcome in our home anytime, sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. It's real hard on Star. And it was clear. The message was clear. I had no defense against it. I said, I understand. And I went and got in my car, and I started to drive home. And I'm driving. I got about a block away, and I'm thinking, God, this man cares more about my daughter than I do. He's protecting her from me. And he didn't say, don't come over here drunk. We're afraid you'll fall in the pool and drown, or afraid you'll break our furniture or embarrass us in front of the neighbors. You know, he said, don't come over here drunk. It's hard on Star. And I'm just like, God, what the hell kind of a father am I that I can't not drink long enough to go and take my daughter to a movie? And I started to cry, and I'm just crying so hard I could hardly see. And I turned on the windshield wipers with... Didn't help. And so I pulled over into a parking lot, and I just sat there and bawled like a baby, and, you know, like we do. And I looked up, and I saw this sign, a neon sign that said, liquor. Help. So I got out of the car and went in, and I bought a pint of whiskey, and I came back, and I had a couple pulls off that jug, and seemed like a help. And I started to drive home. And I know that people in rooms like this understand what I'm talking about. Most people don't, you know. Your average earth person will say something like, sounded like you said you were so distraught over your drinking that you drank. At that time in my life, I had a lot of problems and one solution, you know. Looking at it through light of greater knowledge, I can see that at that point in my life, I had two choices. I was so distraught over my drinking that I could drink or I could stop drinking. And those are the choices. And I was not prepared to stop drinking, so I got a bottle and I drank. And that's what we do. But Teddy had pointed that out. I lost these two jobs. I've been asked not to come to my daughter's house drunk anymore. I could see that, you know, she's got a little bit of a case. So she said, you know, you got drunk and skied off a cliff. Well, yeah, I did. We had gone skiing. And the way I ski is I get up there about 8:30 in the morning and get my skis on, sit on the chairlift, and I'll take my cocaine out of my pocket and my gloves up, and I'll just carefully, you know, have a little one-in-one, put that away. Then I'll get my little whiskey flask out, have a pull on the whiskey, put that away, get my windless pipe, you know, and just smoke all the way up there, put that away, get on my skis, have a little hit off the boater bag, a little wine just to loosen you up, and you know, you get loose, and now I'm a soul skier, you know. Carving them turns, you know, but the problem is, the problem is that if you start this at 8:30 in the morning, by about 4:30, you really shouldn't be participating in an athletic event. And so every time I came up this one run, this one chairlift, I'd come down and this run made a sharp left turn because there's a cliff right there. And every time I passed that, I thought, that doesn't look so hard, really, and the trail is right down below it. I bet I could make that jump, and you know, the more I went by it and the more I drank, the more I thought I could absolutely make it. It's about 25 feet. And so one time I just came by and I just hit that thing and got airborne. And it was right after the Winter Olympics, you know, so it's just fine. They jumped like 70 meters or something like that, 170 meters, I don't know, but 25 feet didn't seem like much. But you know, they lean over their skis. I always thought that was for show. there's a practical reason you do that. It's so that your skis don't go straight up in the air, and that's what happened to me. I came off that cliff, man, the skis went above me, and I came down on my head and busted my shoulder. I'm laying there, oh, like this, and my daughter had been skiing with me that day, and she had to go get the ski patrol, and they came up and took me down. I had to have my shoulder operated on. I was out of work for 6 weeks, and then I I was just barely back to work for a couple of weeks, and I went to this party that lasted all night long, and by the morning, most people were gone. There was about a half a dozen of us left, and the woman who owned the house said, if somebody would take me to the store and get some eggs, I'll make breakfast. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. So we got on my Harley, and we set out to go get some eggs. Harley and eggs, good combination. And but we started out for the store, and we were like, the sun is just coming up on this beautiful, brisk April morning. And the sunrise, it's just like a little bit of cold in the air, but it's not, you know, not freezing. And it just felt great to be in the wind. And we both had the same idea at the same time. Wouldn't it be beautiful to make love in the great outdoors at sunrise? Just seemed like the thing to do. But I don't know if you're familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's hard to find a sexual venue, you know, in the great outdoors down there. So, but we drove around and we found this four-story parking structure, but the gate was locked, but they had the fire escape there. So we parked the bike, we went up the fire escape, and the door is locked. I said, it ain't locked from the inside. So I jumped up on the wall. I'm going to drop myself into that thing. I made the jump, but I didn't get the part about getting over the wall. And I was sort of hanging there, swinging, and I was thinking that I was going to come up with some brilliant idea to get over the top of this wall, and all of a sudden I saw this building going by, you know, and it takes your breath away. It's real exciting. I thought, this is really going to hurt, and 54 feet I fell and landed on hard dirt. And I had, it's funny, for some reason I was riding barefoot that night, so my feet hit the ground and my knees buckled, my foot came up, I kicked myself in the ass, really, which I should have, but it broke my pelvis in two places, and it snapped the heel bone off my foot and sent it right through my foot like a bowling ball, and it just broke a whole bunch of little bones in the foot. And I'm just laying there, but the woman I was with, now here's the thing though, see, God has always been subtly taking care of me. This four-story parking structure was the parking structure for St. Joseph's Hospital. So she went across the lawn and got an ambulance and told the doctors, you know, there's a guy hurt out here, and then she called her husband and he came down and took the bike home, and I'm laying in the hospital, you know, and my foot didn't look like a foot. It looked like a ball of some kind. Plus it was purple and orange and green and black and blue, and it was like a little toe sticking out of it. You go, wow, that's a foot. That's my foot. And doctors would come in and look at it, put x-rays up on the window and chant with each other and stuff. My friends were bringing me in whiskey and cocaine. And it never occurred to me to say to the doctors, look, I know you're giving me Percodan and Demerol for the pain. I'm self-administering Irish whiskey and cocaine. Is that going to be a problem? But I figure it's none of their business. They do their job, I'll do my job. Anyway, so it gave Teddy information that she could use against me right at that moment. She said, if you ever see alcohol interfering with your life, my God, Doug, you lost two great jobs this year. You skied off. You've been asked not to come to your daughter's house. You skied off a cliff and broke your shoulder. You fell off a four-story parking structure with a 0.40 blood alcohol level. Took you 5 months to learn to walk without a cane. What would you call interference? Brain death? And I said, I don't think accidents should count, you know. I think she kind of gave up on me. But all that week, I'd be working, and I'd stop and have a moment of silence, and I could hear Teddy saying, what would you call interference? Brain death? Yep.
So I rushed right down to Alcoholics Anonymous 3 years later. And and as I said, I didn't go to get sober. I went to see what it was. Somebody had told me, if you want them to leave you alone, go to a big meeting. It's a lie. We don't get sober leaving new people alone, you know. But I went to this big meeting that I knew about at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys, California, and it was a Friday night meeting, and there was a couple hundred people there. I went there early. I saw them setting up chairs and making coffee and setting up the literature and all stuff, and I'm sort of getting the feel of the room, and people would come up and say, "Hey, you're new." I said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "Oh, you've been here before? I haven't seen you." No, okay, well, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I'm new like that, but I'm not new like a member. I'm not somebody that's supposed to be here. I'm just here. You know, I'm just checking it out. I'm visiting. So he said, "Okay, you're going to fit right in." And I said, "Okay." That's not his fault. That's my fault. I'm an articulate man. I could have been clearer about this. So the next guy that comes up and says, "Hi, my name's Marv. You're new, right?" I said, "No, I was just telling this other guy. I am new in the sense that I've never been here, but I'm not new like a new member, okay? I'm just auditing the class, pal. I'm visiting, you know what I mean? I'm checking it out. Just seeing what's going on here, that's all. You know, I'm standing over here. In fact, I'm just over here minding my own business. You might try it sometime." The thing is, pal, I'm not a joiner. I never have been, ever. I'm a loner, okay? I'm an outlaw, my friend. I'm a desperado, pal. That's the truth. I'm a misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I don't fit in school. I don't fit in my own damn family. I don't fit in the workplace. I'm certainly not going to fit in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking it? Yeah, I don't think so. I drank on the way here. You know? It's like I fully expect to drink on the way home. I like drinking. I mean, he goes, "Oh, yeah, you're absolutely going to fit right in." I mean, what do you have to do? Shoot somebody here? You know, so. But people were nice to me. I mean, I had, in my own life, I mean, people were nice. You know what I wish I'd had is Bluetooth. As I see new people who today in meetings with the Bluetooth, there's nothing that I can think of that silently proclaims I'm very important. I may get a call any second and have to leave you guys, you know. I was like, beep, beep, and a piece of flashing electronic jewelry in your ear. When I got sober, they didn't have Bluetooth. They didn't have cell phones when I got sober. I got sober in 1986-7. This was 86. But then we had pagers, you know. I mean, they had mobile phones, but they were big. They were in briefcases. They were expensive. Surgeons had them. Producers had them. You know, I didn't have one. I didn't even have a pager because nobody wanted to contact me. "Hey, hi, it's Doug. Are you guys going to be home? I'm going to come visit." They go, no, we're not, Doug. We're just walking out the door, man. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know when we'll be back. Long time though. Don't come over here. Okay. Love you, Mom. But I didn't have a pager, but what I had was I had a garage door opener with a belt clip on it. You know, so it looked like somebody might want to contact me. You're a practicing alcoholic, it's a handy deal, because just any time you get bored with the conversation, you know, and your drink alarm says, "Shut up, go get a drink," you can just go, "Oh, I got to get this. Be right back." And it's cool, unless somebody says, "What is that? It looks like my garage door opener." Well, it is. It's a combination, garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. It's the latest, coolest thing. I got one. So I'm standing in this meeting watching people, you know, hug and laugh. And there's another guy standing against the wall on the other side of the double doors. And I thought, okay, we're birds of a feather, man. We're the cool section here. And we were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We were like... And they started their meeting, and they read stuff, and somebody talked about themselves for most of the meeting. And the funny thing is, I can't tell you tonight if the speaker was a man or a woman. What he or she said. It may have been the greatest speaker AA has. It may have been somebody that wasn't. I have no idea. I just have no idea who the speaker was. I remember people were nice to me. I remember they had a cake that night. The secretary said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And everybody's, yay, Ruth. And I'm looking around for some 18-year-old tiny Heidi. Where Ruth? And Ruth gets up. She's the only one standing up and walking towards the stage. And so that's Ruth. But Ruth is 50 if she's a day. And my first thought was, God damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking. But not because she looked bad. I mean, she didn't look bad. She looked good. She just, you know, she looked great for 50. A little whip for a teenager is all. But as I'm thinking that, everybody starts to sing. Now, I didn't know about birthdays and birthday cakes and AA birthdays, but everybody started singing. I figured it out. This woman is 50. She's 18 years sober. It's probably a national record. That's probably why they're excited about it. And so then everybody started singing, like 200 people singing happy birthday in four different keys at the same time, loud and bad. Many of them were not even committed to the key they started in. And they had a piano. It was a stage meeting like this. And they had a piano up there with a sheet over it. And I'm thinking, somebody in this room can play Happy Birthday on the piano. It's a three-chord song. Somebody can. I could do it. Maybe I will. That's what I should. I should run up there and yank that sheet off. Hold it, folks. Here I come to save the day. You know, and just get everybody in the key of G and save the day. And then I thought, no, maybe not. Everybody I talked to, I told them I wasn't staying. So I really got no lines in this show. Just shut up. It's a short song. So they finished it up. And then Ruth gets up. She says, my name's Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And everybody goes, hi, Ruth. And I'm, Jesus Christ. Hi, Ruth. I just bought a ticket to Lamesville, I think. You know, my friend Scott used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. So I look over at the other cool guy, you know, then Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And I'm what? And it seemed like people were impressed with that. Not me. I'm going, you're a little slow, ain't you, honey? You're just not the sharpest knife in the drawer, are you, Ruthie? No. And I can hardly hold my chuckles, and I look over at the other cool guy, who is not cool. I don't know why he's standing back there, but he's a member. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something, but he is now heading over to me with his hand extended and that, you know, sunbeam for Jesus smile. And he takes my hand in both hands and he says, I'll tell you what, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. Know what this guy's drinking pattern was, but somehow he thought I would be impressed with the idea if I don't drink for 365 days that a cake would be a temptation to me. I heard him right. He said, don't drink for a year and you will give you a cake. And I don't want to hurt his feelings, but I said, you know, I'm not a big pastry eater. If I wanted a cake, I'd just stop at Safeway on the way home. I think they're like $5. It's not even out of my way. I got to stop and get a six-pack anyway. So, but gosh, thanks. And then the secretary said something. She held up this book, held up this hardcover book. She said, "This is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a basic text of our program. It's the only authority on AA. If you're new, please don't leave without this book." So I thought, I'm new. I will steal that book. And I could do it. They had a bunch of them just sitting on a table. And I knew, I just had a feeling I could go pick one of those books up, act like I was fascinated with it. This is fantastic. This is really going to help. Wow. Oh, yeah. And walk right out the door. And I just had a feeling if they even noticed, they'd say, "Leave them alone." I don't know, but I could hardly wait to try it. And then she said something that screwed it up. She said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have the book, and we'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. I know that sounds loving and generous, unless you're going to steal the book. And then I'm not going to look like some clever thief. I'm going to look like a homeless guy, you know, and an idiot. Look at that. He's stealing the book and it's free, you know. And I'm sorry, I have my pride, you know. So now I know I have to buy this book. It's just, I will steal from you, but I'm going to accept your damn charity. And so after the meeting, I got to stay for the whole meeting. And after the meeting, I went up to her. I said, "Hey, could I buy one of your books?" She said, "Oh, the big book." "Yeah, the big book. I've seen bigger." "How much is that big book?" She said, "It's $4.65. Do you have it?" I figured it'd be $20-$25, a hardcover book. $4.65 for a hardcover book? Yeah, I think I can handle that. Here's a five. Keep the change." She said, "No, I'll get your change. Wait right here." "No, please, ma'am. Keep the change. Use that to help a drunk, okay? I'm on my feet, all right?" So so I took the book, and I stopped on the way home and got a bottle of whiskey. So I got my bottle and my book, and I get home, pour about three fingers of whiskey, and I started to read this book. And I don't mean like study it. You know what I mean? I stayed up all night studying. I just kind of skimmed it. You know, I wanted to see what it was about. Some of it I didn't even bother with. The doctor's opinion? I've had doctor's opinions. So I got into the basic text. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter 2, there's a solution. And that's a sales pitch. It's obvious. "Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams." Skip that one. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, which sounded to me like maybe the most boring piece of literature in the English language. In fact, it sort of reminded me, just the title, more about alcoholism, like those six great health movies you watch, you know, on 16 millimeter, more about alcoholism. I'm already past the first three chapters. I'm going to save that one until some night when I'm tweaking and feel like I got toothpicks in my eyes. Read more about alcoholism. Fade right out. And so I'm already up to chapter 4, We Agnostics, which absolutely shocked me, just the title. By the way, I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter in any book and pretty much know everything that's in the chapter. It's a gift that I have. But this one shocked me, because when I went to my first AA meeting, I expected AA to be the secular way to get sober, the way people get sober without God. I don't know why I thought. Well, I know why I thought that. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister, and she had a Skid Row mission in San Pedro on Beacon Street, and she used to help drunks to get sober. She helped them to save their souls, but then along the way they would stop drinking. And she didn't care for AA, so I thought she didn't like AA because there was no God here. But it was something else. I don't know exactly, but I found out when I walked to my first meeting, everybody's talking about my higher power and power greater than yourself, and humbly asked him with a capital H and admitted to God and told God and prayed to God. And after, oh my God, the last house on the block is Sunday school. And I'm just, Jesus. And so I was very irritated. But now I'm reading this book the secretary had said was the only authority. Got a whole chapter called We Agnostics. I said, all right, this is how the smart people do it without God. So I poured another three fingers of whiskey, and I read chapter 4 all the way through. Got done, and I thought, I have absolutely no idea what I just read. So I poured some more whiskey, and I read it again. And I'm like, focus, focus, focus. It's not saying what I want it to say, so I'm just not accepting what it's actually saying. It amazes me now that I must have, after reading it 5 or 6 times, had missed the first paragraph that says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop drinking entirely, or once you start drinking, you find you have no control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. First paragraph. But I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I'm just looking for how the smart people stay sober without God. And after drinking a few drinks and reading it a few times, I was able to focus on some of the black part. And a sentence in there that maybe most of us miss, because it's written kind of subtly, but it's incredibly significant. It says, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. I didn't catch that the first few times I read it. But eventually, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. What's significant about it is I never heard that anyplace else. I had studied, mildly studied some religions, some world religions, and it seemed to me that every religion that I knew about, every sect of every religion I knew about, said there are certain spiritual hoops you have to jump through or to get God's attention, or you cannot communicate with God. You're not available. My grandmother's Pentecostal church never said God doesn't make too hard terms. If anything, it seemed to me they said just the opposite. I would go there on a Sunday morning or a Sunday evening or a Tuesday evening or a Wednesday evening, and Brother Van Dyke would be at the pulpit. He'd say, hello! I'd walk in that church. They call me, dude. They'd say like, oh, hello, dude. I hope you brought your guitar, dude. And Brother Van Dyke would say something like, we are very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek him. Boy, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. Now I'm talking about total submersion, boy. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up, boy. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody get that boy a towel. It scared me, I said, I don't know what's going on, but I maybe she told him I touched myself. But there's a strong possibility they're going to send my ass to Jesus for my own good. I know one thing, I'm not getting wet in this room tonight. And I'm 14 years old. I said, I got brand new Levi's on. They're shrink to fit. And if I get in there, I won't be able to ride my bicycle home, boy. But I sure would like to some other time. I'll see you, and I'm out of there. But you could go, okay, well, the Pentecostals, yeah, they're a little over the top. No, I mean every sect of every religion I knew about. My girlfriend was a Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons to discover how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers could cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. Did he say various kinds of sins? If you're Catholic, I ain't bullshitting. They got them categorized over there. Venial, menial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them you don't even have to do them if you think about them. Expressway to hell, partner. Really? Don't think about sin. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm right on top of that. But she and her family would go to catechism and genuflection and whatever. They were happy doing it. I didn't bother them, but I didn't go back with them either. And my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and he and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school, which I always thought, oh, yeah, there's a loving God for you,
Thou shalt wear spit curls to public school. We'll make a fighter of you yet, young man.
I went over to Michael's house for lunch one time, or for dinner. I went over, and their mom said, "Doug, would you like to join us in some wine and challah?" I said, "Some what?" She said, "Would you like to join the family in some wine and challah?" I said, "Well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater." Then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. So I just said, "Hey, I'm done. All the religions of the world over there. I'm over on this side of the line making fun of you." And that's the guy that came to AA. But I'm looking at this book. It says that we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Goes on to say, you don't have to accept anyone's concept of God. If you read this chapter and understand what it says, it's pretty clear you're going to have some kind of concept of a power greater than yourself. Some kind of a concept of the source of the universe. But nobody can tell you what it is. You can find one of your own. And whatever you're comfortable with, that seems to be okay with the Creator. I never heard anything like that before. And there's another part in that chapter that I love that says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives for many of us. That's nuts. That's just nuts, you know. And nobody in here, everybody's going, "Yeah, that's right." To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis is not an easy alternative. Go get yourself a clipboard and stand in front of Walmart sometime. Stop people when they come up. "Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life?" And you may find out that the earth people don't think an alcoholic death is something to look forward to. You know, most of them will go get in the long line. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, they think it's kind of a no-brainer, in fact. A very inquisitive normie might say something like, "Okay, when you say alcoholic death, you're talking about where you puff up and turn yellow and then choke to death on your own blood and vomit and bile?" "Well, you make it sound bad." Yeah. I'll take that spiritual deal, you know, I mean, only us. In fact, if you ever do that Walmart test, you know if you found one of us. Alcoholic death is spiritual life, and you get this. "You're going to be here tomorrow." Yeah, what are you doing tomorrow? Let's go over to the Riverside Hotel with me, you know. This thing got my attention. And what happened was I went back to a meeting. And I started liking AA. The more meetings I went to, the more I liked it. And the more I started to believe, you people drank like I drank, and you don't drink anymore. And it's pretty clear. I was going to meetings, and I was going to five or six a day. I mean, not a day, but a week. And at one meeting that I was at, everyone who shared, it was a participation meeting, everyone who shared I identified with. I said, "Oh my God, I've never been in a room full of Dougs before. I've never been in a room full of people who everything they shared was my personal innermost thoughts." And I could not stay away from AA. I started falling in love with it. Now, my first 8 months in AA, I got to tell you, I didn't do anything right. Not really. I mean, I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. Except for that stuff, I had a pretty good program, you know, which was keep coming back. That's the only thing I did right. At some point, I got tired of raising my hand as a newcomer all the time. Anybody with less than 30 days, Doug alcoholic. We have any new friends with under 30 days, Doug alcoholic. And finally, I got tired of it. I said, "I'm not raising my hand. It's none of the damn business anyway." So some girl at the end of the table said to her friend, "Doug's got 30 days. Oh, my God. I didn't mean to mislead anybody. I just, you know, I... So I didn't. So I took a 30-day chip, you know. And it made everybody so happy. I didn't want to make this girl look bad. You understand? You know, she was on my 13-step list, and. Please don't misunderstand. This was not a list of people I had had 13 steps with. It was a list of perspectives. You know, it was. In fact, there was a girl on that list that after I did get sober, we went out. And I expected her to check her off. She would be the first one on a long list of conquests. And she was the first one and on the last one on a short little list. I mean, we ended up going out together. Then she moved in and we lived together for 6 years. And we got married and we were married for 9 years. And we were together for 15 years. And then we kind of had different interests and different lives. And we were more like brother and sister than husband and wife. And so we split up. But see, that's why they tell newcomers don't get in a relationship in your first year. You know, I was 21 days sober when she 13-stepped me. And it was beautiful and loving and happy for 15 years, but then it fizzled, you know. So anyway, but it was a good thing. Randy taught me how to ask questions. I'm not a question asker by nature. I like to have you ask the question, and then when I get the answer, say, that's right, as if I knew it all the time. Something in my head says, don't ask that question. They'll think you don't know the answer, you know. So. But we were in bed one night, and I had my leg on her side of the bed, and she grabs it like a log. She said, God damn, get over on the other side of the bed. She said, God, you sleep like Jim Parks. So I don't know any Jim Parks. I didn't say that to her. I said it to myself. I don't know any Jim Parks. Why did she say that? I know she had a promiscuous past. Excuse me, I had a promiscuous past too, but I do not bring them into the matrimonial bed. It's rude. It's thoughtless. It's pointless. Why would you do that? And I thought, is there a Jim P at the group that I... She was sober 2.5 years when I got there. And maybe, another possibility is she's a voracious reader. What if I say, who's Jim Parks? And she says, oh, you're not familiar with Lady Chatterley's Lover. You know, or... I'm sorry, I thought you had read For Whom the Bell Tolls. You know, I don't want to look like an idiot, but I'm laying there working on this resentment, and I know all I have to do is say, who's Jim Parks? But I don't want to do that. But I think, on the other hand, I'm going to be wearing this thing. Nobody's going to know it. It's going to affect my work. It's going to affect my life. And 3 days later, she's going to say something innocent like, did you mean to leave your boots in the dining room? And I'll just go. I'll just blow, you know, like, boots! Boots my ass, bitch! Boot down on this! Who's Jim Parks? You know, so all I have to do is ask a question. So I said, I'm sorry, honey. Am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And Randy's a cackler. She's like, you know Jim across the street. What? Jim across the street? Yeah, you know how he puts his truck so you can't park in front of him or behind him without blocking a driveway? You sleep like Jim Parks. He still lives there. He brought Carla and I an orchid for our wedding. He still doesn't know. The yard was full of people that have heard me talk about him. He doesn't know. Anyway. Anyway, so I'm back at this meeting, and I took a bogus 30-day chip. And it made everybody feel so good. I went over to Chandler Lodge the next day and took a bogus chip. Then I went to all these different places. I'm taking chips all over the place. And I got different sobriety dates at different groups. I was at the Valley Club, and I heard this girl say, my sponsor said, I can't have sex till I'm sober 6 months. So I took a 6-month chip over there. Just in case, you know. So anyway, so I got a bad program. I don't have any program, really, but I'm going to AA regularly. Everybody that I know thinks I'm sober. People who would rather that I drank think I'm sober. Every drink I take is by myself, and I'm drinking every day. Finally, what happened was one day I came home from a meeting. I had a bottle of whiskey with me. I laid on the floor, and I turned on the TV, and I drank till I passed out. I had a fifth of whiskey, and I woke up, and the bottle was half full. TV was on. I turned the TV off. I got my bottle. I crawled on my hands and knees through the house to go to bed, through the living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom. Some people call that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. When you're doing it, you just call it going to bed, you know. I remember the first time I thought of doing that, I thought it was brilliant. Hey, you can't fall off the floor. And